Welcome back to His Time. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is Friday, March 20th, 8:05 Central Time. That means it is time to study the daily New Testament reading. Our guest pastor joining us by phone today, Pastor Paul Terhune from Hope Lutheran Church in Glendora, California. Good morning, Pastor Terhune.
Good morning. Yeah, it's very dark still here, 2 hours time difference. Hope is located about 15 miles east of Pasadena, and our congregation operates a school, a preschool. We enjoy getting guests and visitors, especially when you're fleeing the cold of the Midwest. We're expecting it in the 80s today.
Very good, very good. And glad to hear that you are there delivering God's good gifts in word and sacrament. And
Thank you.
How long has Hope Lutheran Church been in Glendora?
We were founded in the 50s, and I came about 22 years ago, so we're pretty stable, and we've, you know, especially provided a ministry of education to the community. We're noted for that, and that's our strong point.
Well, very good, very good. Well, today we are studying Mark chapter 13, verses 24 through 37. Anything you'd like for us to know about this text before we dig in?
This is, of course, the second part of chapter 13, which is really the only speech of Jesus in the gospel according to Mark. And it has two kinds of qualities to it. One is that it represents what we call a testament, where Jesus, before he is going to be crucified, gives kind of a final speech that sums up things that he wants people to know. You see that also in the Gospel of John, where it goes on for several chapters, and, you know, there are some Old Testament models for that, too. It also is what we call an apocalypse, and that means that it reveals things about what is going to happen in the future, although it's not a normal apocalypse. There's no heavenly vision. There's no bizarre images like in Revelation, for example. No mention of the general resurrection or the judgment. And probably most important, and this is a theme that Mark comes back to, is that there's a denial that you can figure out the time when Jesus is coming again. Jesus is much more concerned to warn his followers against false messiahs and expectations for the wrong kind of messiah. He wants to prepare his community for a continuing time of trial. And a very important thing that's often overlooked is that he wants to connect the passion and the end of the world. That Mark considered this really important is indicated by he has a phrase that he puts into the speech, "Let the reader understand." Mm-hmm. And so he's making the point that, you know, to his immediate audience, that he understands these things to be happening right then and there. And that invites us to, you know, ask the question of, how does he use this kind of speech of Jesus, this language that Jesus uses, to understand a contemporary situation? And eventually, of course, we have to do that too. You know, we have to say, okay, Jesus gives us this end-of-the-world language. Now, for 2,000 years, we've had it, more or less, and the world hasn't ended yet. So what are we going to take away from that language in order to understand our present life and situation better?
Very good. Well, let's take a look at Mark chapter 13 today, verses 24 through 37. Listeners, if you have questions or comments as we're studying with Pastor Terhune from Hope Lutheran Church in Glendora, California, give us a call or an email, 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email us, KFUO at KFUO.org. Let's take a look, Mark chapter 13, beginning at verse 24. "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." In those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Sounds pretty significant, pretty dramatic, Pastor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these events, of course, will happen in the future when Jesus returns, but that doesn't mean they can't be applied over and over again in all of the presents that God's people have to deal with. The language itself parallels Isaiah 13, and you can see by going back there how this process happens. If we were to look for a minute at Isaiah 13:10, it goes, "For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light." And then Isaiah goes on to talk about the destruction of Babylon at the hands of the Medes. And so what you have is the heightening of something that God is going to do in the present by bringing in the language of the end of the world in order to show that, you know, God does act and God does things to save his people. And Christians, I think, throughout history have taken this language, and, you know, sometimes they've genuinely thought that the world was ending in their own particular time when they had to deal with very difficult circumstances. Obviously, it didn't end because we're still here. But they drew comfort from these words, knowing that God was going to come and involve himself in rescuing and saving them. And though they were persecuted, though they were delivered to councils, hauled before kings, or whatever it might be, that nevertheless, God was going to act in a way to save them. Now, not dramatically necessarily, but the way that God chooses to act many times is through suffering, through the cross. And that's very much what Mark is trying to do as well. He's trying to show that the people of his age, and Jesus, of course, has done this by giving us these words, that even though things are bad at the moment, that God hasn't forgotten them and that God will work his ways no matter what. All things work together for good for those who love him.
And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Let's just look at verse 26 before we go on to 27, and there's so much in both of these. They will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory.
Mm-hmm.
How will his power and glory be revealed? Yes, go ahead.
Again, every eye will see him, Jesus says, when he returns elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Again, it's language that would be familiar to God's people. In this case, it comes not from Isaiah, but comes from Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel has the vision of one like a son of man coming. And, you know, that in Daniel, that coming of the Son of Man is contrasted, you may be familiar, with this vision of beasts that, you know, rise from the earth, from the sea, that sort of thing. But the Son of Man comes from heaven. That's the one, finally, that God is acting through. It's through our Lord that he acts to save us, and not through, you know, the various things of this world, political agendas or economics or what have you. It's always through Christ that we see his action to step in and to save. And when the end comes, of course, everyone is going to see Jesus as he returns in glory. There's no escaping at that point.
And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Who does he gather? He sends out his angels and gathers who?
The elect. the gathering of God's people is pretty much a commonplace in the Old Testament, but here the difference is that it's of the new Israel, you know, and that's indicated in part from the fact that it comes from everywhere, you know, people are brought in from all the earth. Jesus' return happens after the gospel is preached to the whole world. And, you know, the four corners imagery comes from Zechariah 2. And so it's not simply like God returning the people from captivity in Babylon, or that it's the church. It's those that God has called in to follow his son, Jesus Christ.
Looking at this first section alone, verses 24 through 27, anything else about this before we go on to the lesson of the fig tree?
Well, there's always more, but I don't want to run out of time.
I think we're good on time if you have any other points before we go on to the next section.
One of the things that's constantly in the background in this chapter, and it speaks to the context in which Mark writes the gospel. If you're expecting Jesus to return immediately, as were people in the earliest days of the church, there's little point in writing a gospel because it's not going to be worth the time that you have to invest in putting it out. And so consequently, when it's becoming clear, as it is to Mark, that things are going to go on for a while, then of course you want to write down what Jesus said under the direction of the Holy Spirit, because the initial generation of Jesus' followers, the eyewitnesses, are beginning to die off. You see that problem in John 21. If we believe the testimony of the early church, then Mark is connected to Peter. And Peter dies in 60s A.D. under the persecution by Nero. And so we can possibly place the writing of this gospel at a time when the Jews are revolting against Rome. They're revolting because they believe that Messiah has come. Unfortunately, it's not the right Messiah. You know, they're following people who are not Jesus, but nevertheless claim to be him, come in his name, saying, "I am." And that's why something the size of Orange County, Judea, will take on the whole Roman Empire. It's like Orange County fighting the U.S. Doesn't make sense unless you think that this is God's Messiah. Well, Mark's saying, wait a minute, it's not. You know, this is not Jesus coming back again in 66 A.D., that, in fact, the way that Jesus rescues you is through the cross. It's not through a political agenda or any such thing. And so there's a constant thing in this chapter 13 about contrast between messiahs and expectations that people have, and instead the way that God saves us in spite of our suffering, in spite of persecution, through the suffering of Christ on the cross.
Very good. Well, we need to take a quick break. When we come back from that break, we'll continue studying the daily New Testament reading. We'll take a look at the lesson of the fig tree and then verses 32 through 37 as well. Stick around for more His Time. Oh, and by the way, if you have questions or comments, give us a call or an email, 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Cross Defense, the apologetic show for inquiring minds of all ages. Cross Defense airs Mondays from 2 to 3 p.m. on air, online, on demand, right here on Worldwide KFUO. A long-standing tradition at Worldwide KFUO is to broadcast two Sunday morning worship services. From Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County, Senior Pastor Dennis Castens presides during the early worship service at 8 a.m. The live late worship service at 10:45 comes from Hope Lutheran Church in St. Anne, Missouri, where Pastor Tim Ostermeyer leads worship. Hear the message of mercy and forgiveness through Jesus Christ during Sunday morning worship on Worldwide KFUO.
Welcome back to His Time. I'm your host, Andy Bates. We are studying the daily New Testament reading today with Pastor Paul Terhune from Hope Lutheran Church in Glendora, California. We're in Mark chapter 13 today, verses 24 through 37. Pastor, are we ready to go on to verse 28?
Mm-hmm.
All right, here we go. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Ah, so a lesson from the fig tree. Learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this paragraph has caused a lot of ink to be spilled for a variety of reasons. One of the things, I have to get a plug in again for Southern California, is we actually have fig trees here. So, yeah, we get to see this happen. The climate here is very much like where it is in Jerusalem and in Israel in general. And most of the trees actually are evergreen. And so the fig tree is an exception. It does drop its leaves regularly, and then all of a sudden it buds out in the way that people in the rest of the country are used to starting in May or June. And so it's possible that Jesus is simply using this sign as a way of reminding people that things happen and change very suddenly. And so just as the coming on of the leaves on the fig tree is sudden, so Jesus' coming is sudden. Other people will see this as parabolic in a way, too. You'll remember that Jesus cursed the fig tree when he was going into Jerusalem. And usually that's interpreted as a parabolic picture of the Israel and the Jewish people of his day, all show and no fruit. There is a connection that we're supposed to draw between the two fig trees, the one in Jesus' speech here and the one that is cursed, then this would hold out hope that things are going to change for the Jewish people before Jesus returns. Some would see it that way. Verse 29 is kind of difficult because we're not quite sure what things we're supposed to see. And there are three ways that you could understand it. The nearest antecedent in what he says is the end of the heavens. Well, that's too late really to be a sign to do anything about. Second possibility is he's referring earlier in the chapter when he discusses the destruction of the temple and that, and the events of 66-70 is when that's fulfilled. But in reality, these don't trigger the end in itself. So probably it's to be understood in a general kind of way. But a third and intriguing thing is maybe he's talking about his passion also. That brings up the difficult verse about this generation passing away. People will try to explain that in lots of different ways. They'll make generation mean mankind or whatever, but the plain and obvious meaning of the text is that something big, end of the world type thing is going to happen before the people that Jesus is speaking to pass on. And, a lot of that is fulfilled, at least up front. The beginning of it is fulfilled in the Passion. In 13:2, Mark talks about the temple being destroyed. That's the charge that's brought against him on trial. The speech is set on the Mount of Olives. They go out to the Mount of Olives for the Passion. People come saying, "I am." In the trial, Jesus says, "I am," is taken as blasphemy. Jesus warns about being delivered up to councils, beaten in synagogues, standing before governors. He's delivered to the synagogue, the Sanhedrin. There he is beaten. He stands before Pilate. Brother delivers up brother. He's betrayed by one of his companions. There's the advice in chapter 13 to flee. The disciples flee. Tells you in 13, don't return for your mantle. You've got this strange thing of the young man fleeing naked in Mark. Pray to be spared great testing, that it be in winter. In Gethsemane, Jesus prays that he would be spared, that the cup would pass. Pray that you don't enter into testing. Could you not watch for 1 hour, he says to the disciples, and watches all over the place in chapter 13. The sun is going to be darkened. The sun is eclipsed when Jesus dies. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. He says that to the high priest in the Passion. It goes on and on. The four time of the day when the master may return, three of those are specifically mentioned in the Passion, one's alluded to. Then you've got other things, too. I mean, Matthew, in his gospel, mentions the earthquake, the rising of dead saints. So clearly there's an attempt here to connect the two. Yeah, this speech of Jesus on the Mount of Olives and what's going on when he's crucified. In addition, you've got Jesus' own vow that he's not going to drink of the fruit of the vine until he drinks of it new in the kingdom. And then on the cross, he, of course, initially refuses the wine, but then at the end, he thirsts and he drinks it. And so, you know, we have to take him at his word. That means that in some sense, you know, the kingdom comes in already at that point. And so Mark is reminding his followers not to look for the coming of Christ and the coming of the end and the kingdom of God in the events that are happening in Jerusalem as he writes, but instead to focus your attention on where it really starts. And where it really starts is in the death of Christ on the cross. That it's through, you know, suffering that Jesus brings in the kingdom. Now, of course, it's going to be fulfilled when he returns again in glory in its completeness. But instead of looking for, you know, Jesus to be coming next week or whatever, instead focus on how that kingdom has already begun in his death on the cross. And that's what we're doing in the season of Lent, you know, even as we speak.
Hmm. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Everything else will pass away, but my words will not pass away. What does this tell us about his words?
That they are true, that they are reliable, and if you're really going to look for help or relief when things are rough, look for it in the Word. Don't look for it in false messiahs. Don't look for it in you know, contemporary events or any of that sort of stuff, but to focus on Christ and you know, his suffering and death on the cross, because that's where, you know, relief comes from. And how do we know about that? We know about that through the Word, which is reliable, you know, which, you know, God's inspired every bit of it. And so we can look to that to find the true hope and the true comfort. We shouldn't, you know, nobody likes to suffer, but it is in suffering that God's love, God's power, God's graciousness to us is most clearly revealed.
What does this tell us about everything else, then? Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not. What does this tell us about everything else?
The time will come when the world will end, just as, you know, the time was when God created it. It will end. We're going to get to that also in the next paragraph of you know, what should we be doing in the meantime. So, yes, it's going to pass away. We should not rest our hopes on things of this world because they don't endure, but we should rest our hopes on what God reveals to us in his word, and we can take word in two senses there. It's not just the scriptures, but it's also Jesus Christ, and especially Jesus Christ himself as the word, you know, the word made flesh.
Very good. Anything else about this section before we go into verse 32, Pastor?
No, I think there's enough there.
There is quite a bit there. All right, let's take a look at verses 32 through 37 today. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son of Man, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or when the rooster crows or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. All right. Concerning that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that people don't try to figure it out. They waste a lot of time. If they would just simply take Jesus at his word, you can't figure it out. Now, admittedly, there's some tension with the idea earlier in the speech that there are signs in that, but the signs are kind of minimal. The desolating abomination that refers to the false messiahs, it's he, and the heavens disintegrating, that kind of sign, it's too late. And then we have the fig tree. Those are basically the three that Jesus gives. But the point that he's trying to make is that you can't figure that out. Even according to his human nature, Jesus himself doesn't know. According to his divine nature, he would. But during his ministry, of course, he doesn't always act from his divine nature. So he can say that the Son of Man doesn't know at that point. But here's where you really get to the heart of what you should be doing. Rather than trying to figure things out, you should be keeping on task. That's what the second part of the paragraph is about. there's a story, probably apocryphal, told about Luther that it's also told about Francis of Assisi. It's one of those good stories that you take someone you respect and you attach it to them. He was supposed to have been observed planting a pear tree, and the fellow that saw him doing this said, what happens if Jesus returns again? Look, all the signs are there and that sort of thing. You'll never get to eat from the fruit of that tree. And the reply was to the effect that, so what? I'm going to be planting it anyway because that's what I'm supposed to be doing at this time in this place. And that fits in with this. I mean, if you C.S. Lewis uses the image too of a soldier who maybe is stuck in a foxhole somewhere on a active front line of a battle, and he can't see the big picture. He doesn't know when the enemy is going to come immediately. But what's his duty? His duty is to stay there, to watch, and to do his task of being a good soldier. And that's true for us, too, is that God calls us to various things, duties in this world. We have many hats that we wear. For many of us, it will be husband, father. It will be our particular job. Maybe it is a police officer, a judge in a court. Maybe it's a medical doctor, a teacher, who knows what. But those are the things that God has given us in order to do his tasks, his job in the world. And until the world does happen to end, that's our job. It's not to be figuring out his job, when he's going to return to save us. It's to do the job that he has given us. But always to do it with, with a watching in the back of our mind, that we do this not simply to earn a living or to do whatever it is that we want to do, but we do it for God. And so, one eye, I suppose we could say, is on the task that we're given. The other eye is on the Lord, knowing that, he will come again. And it's not just simply that, that we're going to be held accountable for what we do or what we don't do in those callings that God gives us, but we want to do them because that's where he has placed us, and so to keep on task is far better than to keep on speculating, about what's going to happen or what's not going to happen in the future.
Speculating. It's always fun.
Every generation thinks, there's some people who think that, Jesus has to come in my generation. On one level, that's good, I suppose, because it means they're taking his word seriously of being prepared. But on another level, I think there's a little bit of pride at work there, too. Is that none of us can really stand the idea that the world is going to go on without us. And so we always assume we're in the last act.
going back to verse 32, but concerning that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. In our house, and you can share with me your thoughts on this too, we generally say that, we can know for certain that when someone says that Jesus is coming back on this day at this time, we can know for certain that that's not when it's going to happen, because Jesus tells us here that no one knows the day or the hour. So we could be pretty confident that when someone says Jesus is going to come back at this time on this day, well, it's not going to be then.
Yeah, in fact, St. Paul says, doesn't he? I think it's in 1 Thessalonians or somewhere, that when nobody's expecting him is when he's going to come. And that's Jesus' saying about he comes like a thief in the night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why should we spend so much time trying to defeat the Lord's own words?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by figuring it out.
Yeah.
Much better to stay focused on the task that he sets in front of us.
Stay awake. Yeah.
Yeah.
Stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or when the rooster crows or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. Stay awake, stay focused, do what you're given to do.
I bet Peter wishes that he had taken that advice.
And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake.
Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. So what do we do while we wait for Jesus to come? We stay awake. We stay mm-hmm. focused on what he has given us to do. What is it that he's given us to do?
Those are the callings that we have. It always includes spreading his word. But it also includes the day-to-day vocation in which, Luther is real strong on this, in which we serve God. You know, whether it's the maid who scrubs the floor or it's the prince, sitting in his palace, judging and running the show. That all of these callings, all these vocations are where God wants you to serve him. Now, the key is that you don't do it just to do it. You do it to serve him. And so, one is always watching, for him and doing it in light of the end that Jesus has accomplished to the old order on the cross and the end of the present order when he comes again in glory.
Looking over the text as a whole today, Pastor, anything else you'd like for us to learn from the text?
There's not much you can say after that watch. that's a constant refrain. I mean, there's like three or four different Greek words that Mark is using, and there's six or eight times where he's, it comes look, see, watch. So that's the bottom line, here. It's not speculating. It's watching. It's not trying to figure out things that may or may not be. It's resting confident in what we know will be because Jesus said so. He dies to rescue us. He'll take us home to be with him someday. In the meantime, do the task that your hand finds to do with all your might, because that's God's will for you.
Amen. We've been studying the daily New Testament reading today with Pastor Paul Terhune from Hope Lutheran Church in Glendora, California. Pastor Terhune, thanks so much for being our guest pastor and helping us study this text in Mark 13 today.
You're very welcome.
God bless you and all the saints there at Hope Lutheran Church in Glendora, California. Coming up in just a little bit, Creation Club with Pastor Worth. Listeners, hope you can stick around for that and more His Time. All right here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.